This is lecture number 5. We're starting 2 lectures on constraint, quantum constraints. Constraints are something you live with all your life. When your mother says you can go to the playground, but you've got to cross at the traffic light, that's a constraint on how you can get there. When you come to college and take an examination, and the teacher says, do anything you like, but don't cheat. That's a constraint on what you can actually do. Can start simply with the role of Lagrange nullifiers here with a simple example. At the top, ignore the arc for the moment and concentrate on the blue lines here. Let them represent the height of a function. You're out climbing in the mountains. This is the high point you want to reach. If you had a map with contours on it, say described by this function, you could find the map by finding the extremal point, taking the gradient and asking where that gradient is actually zero. That's two equations, because this is a two-dimensional vector, for two unknowns, x and y, and that will put you to this point at the top. But suppose you have a constraint. There is a path here, this heavy line, the arc, which you're supposed to stay on as you climb the mountain. You can't leave the path. So that's a constraint that you have to be along this particular path. And I want to give a kind of a simple-minded graphical description of what's going on here. I cover up everything else with the circles, and I put on an arrow here which represents the gradient of a particular curve. So here's a little blue arrow representing the gradient of the function f at that particular point. The constraint equation also has gradients. So here is a little arrow indicating the gradient of the red arrow of the curve. Now, what is it that is the property of the maximal height you can reach by being on the constraint? Well, you can actually see it here. You can see it. It's obviously going to be at this point here. This is, you're at the highest of the contours, and you've gone there. And what is characteristic about that is those two curves are tangent to each other. Or, stated another way, their normal vectors are parallel. So that is the signal of the solution to the constraint. Finding the highest point you can be consistent with staying along the constraint. Okay, so what does that mean from the point of view of mathematics? It says that the gradient f, which is a two-dimensional vector, should be proportional to the gradient of the constraint function. In other words, there is a scalar multiplying the gradient function, which gives you the gradient of the constraint gives you the gradient of the function itself. This is a two-dimensional vector, but I have a one parameter that connects them both. So now I have three equations. I have these two equations plus a third equation for my three unknowns in this particular problem, x, y, and lambda. Let's take that to a higher level. We're talking about classical mechanics. Classical mechanics with constraints. You have to understand classical mechanics before we can delve into the quantum mechanics story. So we start with an action functional defined by J number of P's, J number of Q's, so we have P, Q dot here, minus the Hamiltonian, minus several Lagrange multipliers, capital A of the Lagrange multipliers, multiplying capital A different constraint functions. We vary this action according to the independent variables, which are P, Q, and lambda. We get several different equations. We get the Q dot J equation. We get the P dot J equation. And we get the phi alpha equations. So we have two J equations here plus A for the two J plus A variables in the motion, the P's, the Q's, and the lambdas. There is a phase space graph here, and there is a sub-manifold in that, which is called script C, It's the constraint hypersurface. That's its fancy name. The space on which all the phi alphas are identically zero. So that's some manifold, submanifold within the phase space. It's convenient also to re-express these equations of motion, not in terms of derivatives as I've done it here, but in terms of Poisson brackets. And there'll be a good reason for that. I'll explain in a second. So Q dot J is the Poisson bracket with Q with Hamiltonian, and the lambdas outside, the QJs and the phi alphas. Why don't I put the lambdas inside? If I do, then the phi alphas would be outside, but the phi alphas are automatically zero. So even if the lambda alphas depended on the P's and Q's, it would be pointless to take their derivatives because they'd be multiplied by something which is supposed to be zero. Okay, the reason you want to take the Poisson brackets is because you want to take not only Q's and P's here, but you want to take a more general function and get its time dependence. And so the constraint I'm more interested in is the constraint function itself, its time dependence. This is supposed to be zero. It better be true for all time as well. And this is the equation of motion that this constraint function has to satisfy, namely phi alpha Poisson bracket with H. I've had to change the indices of my summation here to beta here, and I have phi alpha Poisson bracket with the phi betas. That has to be zero for all alpha and all time in order for having consistency. There are two extreme cases now that happen, and I want to illustrate those extreme cases pictorially before we actually discuss them analytically. Let's go to our constraint hypersurface and discuss the first possibility. One is, if you start on the constraint hypersurface C, then the equations of motion will keep you there freely. No matter how you start and no matter what you do, you stay on that. That's a possibility. That's called first-class constraint situation. Second-class situation arises here, pictorially. I hope you can get the message. You start on the constrained hypersurface, but the dynamics wants to take you off. So you've got to use the Lagrange multipliers to force you back onto the surface. You go a little bit further, and you dynamics wants to take you off, using the Lagrange multipliers to keep you back on. So those are two extreme situations, and we're going to discuss both.
So the vectors you draw are where normal to the plane. These vectors are...
They're out of the plane. The black and red arrows are both out of the plane. Of course, I'm doing it as if a computer was doing it, so it would make little time steps with the infinitesimal business of calculus that you actually never leave the surface. Okay, so let's look at the first situation here. And this would be the case if this is automatically zero. Namely, if you are on the constraint hypersurface where the phi alpha should be zero, then it means that this term, the Poisson bracket between the two constraints, should also be zero. Well, that could be, it can be a linear combination of the constraints and still be zero. And at the same time, the Poisson bracket of the constraints with the Hamiltonian should vanish. That could either be zero or, at best, a linear combination of the constraints itself. So this is a criterion for a first-class constraint. The coefficients can be either numbers or functions, and one focuses in particular on the coefficients C, alpha, beta, gamma. It looks kind of like a Lie algebra to you, and would be a Lie algebra if the C's were strictly numbers. Well, in some cases they are numbers. And when they are numbers, we call that a closed first-class system. And the famous theories of modern physics, the Yang-Mills theories, are of that particular variety. Their constraints are closed first-class. Sometimes, however, the C, alpha, beta, gammas can be functions of the phase space variables. That's called an open first-class system. And an important set of examples there would be the general relativity situation. It makes it still a first-class story, but qualitatively different, and we'll see when we talk about quantum mechanics of that a little bit, how fundamentally important that is. Notice that if in this equation this term is already zero, and this term is already zero, then it doesn't matter what the lambdas are. It doesn't matter. You're free to choose them. And you still stay on the surface. And that's an important feature of the story, that the set of lambdas are undetermined by the equations of motion. Of course, you can't let them stay undetermined. For example, here is a situation, say, for Q dot, which you have a lambda and you have a d5 by dp. Maybe the phi vanishes, but its derivative may not vanish on the constraint hypersurface. So this would be a non-vanishing coefficient. And in order to solve this equation, you have to know what the lambdas actually are. So you have to choose the lambdas. And that's called a gauge choice. Okay. Okay, now, we talked about what happens if you start on C, but you tend to leave and you must go back, you must be forced back by the lambdas, etc., etc. That's the second class situation. That's when the phi alpha Poisson bracket with phi beta is not zero on the constraint hypersurface. In fact, let's take the extreme case where this matrix, alpha beta matrix, has an inverse. If that's the case, then you use that inverse to solve for the lambdas. Lambda beta is given by this equation here, which then determines the lambdas in order that you actually satisfy the constraint equation phi dot equal to zero. That means, in contrast to the first class situation where the lambdas are undetermined, here the lambdas are fully determined by the equation of motion. Now, those are the two extreme cases, all first class, all second class. And you can have mixed cases where there are some of each. Once you've got the idea that you have too many variables in the system, that some of them are redundant, some of them are unphysical, as said, then you have a problem when you turn to quantization. You have two things to do now. You quantize your system, and you have to reduce it. You have to take the primary variables, if you will, as a fundamental, and do something with the rest of them. In the early days of quantum theory, it was always deemed the right thing to do was to reduce the system classically at first. Find the physical variables of the system and quantize those. I'm not going to advocate that. I'm going to advocate something else. Something that Dirac himself at one point in his life stressed, that you should quantize first and then reduce later. The alternative, of course, is reduced before quantization, and we'll give examples of both of those, and we'll actually show an example where the two do not agree. So the long-held assumption that it doesn't matter which way you do it, quantization and reduction, either way, I claim, is does matter, and that the number one choice is the right one to make. Why is it right? Because if you reduce first, if you reduce your original phase space so that it is no longer flat, and I'm making my arms to look like a non-flat space here for you, then the P's and Q's live on this kind of a manifold. There's no chance of putting Cartesian coordinates on such a manifold. It only exists on a flat manifold. And Dirac in his book, and Schrödinger and Heisenberg both in papers within 1 to 2 years after the initial quantization noted carefully that quantization only works in Cartesian coordinates. Okay, so let's follow the two ways to proceed. The first way is quite short. There it is, between 1 and 2. That's all the Dirac told us to do. Take the constraints as classical functions and promote them to operators. That means that you're taking the original set of P's and Q's and making those into quantum operators, and the function of those, which is called the constraint function, is likewise made into a constraint operator. There may be ordering problems here. Choose an ordering. Make, if this is a real function, which it certainly should be, make this a Hermitian or, at better, even a self-adjoint operator when you can. And then take your original Hilbert space in which the P's and Q's live. Look for a subspace called the physical Hilbert space. In there, the vectors of that physical Hilbert space should have this property. that when the constraint operators act on them, they give you zero. So this is in the zero eigenspace of the constraint operators. Clearly, if I have two such vectors that obey this, I can add them or subtract them. That's a linear combination of those vectors, still satisfies that. So this makes a linear space, which then a linear subspace of the original Hilbert space. Of course, two problems immediately point themselves out to you. If this is true, then certainly the commutator of that is actually on this has to be zero. And do you like the results of that? That's where second-class constraints come in and say, no, I don't like the results. So this method is really only good for first-class system. Secondly, what about the length of the vector? Remember, in truth, that all Hilbert space vectors have finite norm, and the ones that you've picked out here, do they have finite norm or do they have infinite norm? We'll talk about that situation and what to do about it as well. Okay, I say this method works for some first-class systems. Let's talk about a method of Fadeev, which takes the case of number 2. It's the reduction before you do the quantization. So he takes seriously the original classical action, and he wants to integrate that in a phase-based path integral, dp, dq, and d lambda. These are flat measures, so-called flat measures. If there was a measure that looked like that, then it should be translation invariant for p's, for q's, and for lambdas. The point of doing that way is so that you will enforce the classical constraints because you are indeed reducing the system classically before you are quantizing. So here are the delta functionals that emerge from the integral over the d lambdas enforcing the capital A number of constraint functions. Unfortunately, what's left over is most likely to diverge. For example, suppose the phi's were q, just simply the q's themselves. I would say delta of q should be 0, so this part is vanishing because all the q's should vanish. And suppose that Hamiltonian didn't depend on q at all, it was just a function of p. And that meant that the integration over the q's would give you some trouble. Okay, in any case, what do we do with this Mach-Lanczy divergent situation? Here is another picture of the constraint hypersurface, see here. And focus yourself on the lattice of lines running from the southwest to the northeast here, or from 7 o'clock toward 1 o'clock. And observe the following. I claim that these lines represent gauge equivalent sets of points. For example, if this is a point in the phase space which lies on the constraint hypersurface, then the point along here are supposed to be gauge equivalent to those particular points. If this surface was indeed the surface q equal to 0, then various points here labeled by p would correspond to these along here because q generates translations in p. And so q, as the constraint itself, would move you along this line here, which corresponds to different p values. In any case, take those as gauge equivalent sets, and why not pick out just one family from those gauge equivalent sets? That's what this horizontal, more nearly horizontal line is, chi alpha pq equal to 0. This is a slice through that. It's a dynamical gauge fixing. It's not fixing the lambdas. It's fixing some of the p's and q's among themselves, but trying to eliminate the gauge redundancy that is remaining in the system. This is done in such a way that the Poisson bracket between the gauge fixing functions chi alpha and the original constraints, called that delta alpha beta, the Poisson bracket there, is such that the determinant of that is non-zero. All right, so we take our formula up here, which is most likely divergent. We substitute in our gauge fixing formula. That means we insist that a set of chi's are zero. And we put on the determinant that we've just constructed as well in our integrand. Indeed, this determinant is nothing more than the following. If these were originally Q's and these were originally P's to fix it, then the Poisson bracket between P's and Q's is simply a constant, and that determinant would not be there at all. So the fact that the phis and chi's lead to this determinant simply means that you've made a canonical transformation from P's and Q's to something else, and this is the Jacobian of that transformation. All right, so that's, in any case, that is the Fadea prescription. Once you've done this reduction, then you are alleged to carry out the integrations. Well, it is claimed that the integrations look like this. Namely, you have the physical variables left over called P star and Q star. You integrate over the variables P star and Q star. There were originally 2J of these, and you've now taken away 2 times capital A of those. So that tells you how many variables are in this sum, and that's what the formula is supposed to look like. All right. Let's give it a test. Let's see if these two methods always lead to the same answer. In order to show that they do not always lead to the same answer, it suffices, I believe, to give you one counterexample. Here's my problem. Classical action, a single P, a single Q, and a single lambda. Even the Hamiltonian is set equal to zero. Everything is focused on the constraint. And the constraint reads P squared plus Q to the fourth minus a parameter E. That should be zero classically. And the question is, what E values, what values of E yield a bona fide quantization? Okay, what would Dirac do? He would take the constraint, promote it to an operator, P squared plus Q to the fourth minus capital E, let that act on potential vectors psi physical that lie in the physical Hilbert space. Well, we know that there are solutions to this equation because this looks like a Hamiltonian, and all we have to do is adjust the E levels to one value which is in the set of eigenvalues of that equation. That gives you an eigenfunction, which is then appropriate for being in the physical Hilbert space. So yes, there are a set of E values which give a reasonable or a meaningful quantization, and that set happens to coincide with the eigenvalues themselves. Okay, what would Fadeev say? He starts out by enforcing the constraint. So here is the constraint. You integrate that d lambda over there. You get a delta functional, and that says we're going to enforce that p squared plus q to the fourth minus e is identically zero for all time. I've drawn a picture off here to the right in a pq space. E is a constant. Of course, it has to be positive in order to have this to be zero. So that's a kind of any distorted ellipse, if you will. Of course, the Q fourth makes it not an ellipse, but it's some kind of elliptical-like shape, this arc here. Okay, we're going to have trouble, so we put in our gauge-fixing choice. My choice will be negative P equals zero, and my Fadeev pop-off determinant, the delta that we talked about before, the Poisson bracket of the gauge fixing with the constraint function is simply minus P with this term, so that becomes the derivative of Q to the fourth, or 4Q cubed for every point in time. Here it is. This is the determinant that comes from that. Product over this quantity T, 4Q cubed at every point. That's the Fadeev pop-off determinant. This is the gauge fixing term here, delta of my gauge choice P. And this is the constraint function over here. Well, now we can do our integral. Let's do the P integration. This says evaluate P equal to zero. If P equals zero, this term disappears, and this term disappears. So we're left with delta of Q to the fourth minus E, that, and this Fadeev pop-off determinant. Now, I've drawn in my picture also the 2 points where P equals zero intersect my curve. When P equals zero, I have this point as a solution to Q fourth minus E equals zero, and this point equals that. So it's a positive Q and a negative Q. This point over here corresponds to the true Fadeev pop-off determinant. And this point over here corresponds to the so-called Grieboff copy, if you've ever heard of that. So we have a Grieboff copy in this case. And how does that play out? Well, we're down to this line here. We want to evaluate this integral. There's two ways to do it. One, I take only the points over here where Q is positive. Arbitrary choice, but I do it. Q positive. If Q is positive, then I can put 4Q cubed into the measure at every point T as d of Q to the power 4. And then when I integrate Q to the power 4 over the positive line, I will use this delta function and get unity out of this. So I get some constant, depending on what this m in front is, but at least I get a constant independent of capital E. Second choice. Suppose I say, no, I want to take both solutions, Q and negative Q, into account. Q positive and Q negative. If I do that, then this integral will have a positive contribution and have a negative contribution coming from every time the Q sits on the left-hand side. And the positive and negative contributions are equal in magnitude. It will cancel out, so I get I equal to 0. In either case, insisting on Q positive or Q both sides, I get an answer which is independent of E. There is no restriction placed on the capital E. So the Fourier method did not give us a trick to help us decide how to choose our E. Therefore, I claim it gave us a different answer, and I claim that the Dirac answer is to be preferred. Okay, now we're going to take a small break for exercise between our constraint of the quantum world to discussion to discuss something else. A little bit. It's also about coherent states, but it's even bigger than coherent states. It involves situations of a certain kind, which I'll explain here, and leads to a concept of a reproducing kernel Hilbert space. Now, physicists, I find, are woefully ignorant of the concept. I see a nice blank space right here. reproducing kernel Hilbert space, but I think it's a powerful concept, and I want to make sure you heard about it. If there's a mathematician or two in the audience, they have a good chance of having heard about it. Let's take a set of vectors labeled by a point little l in a label space. I'm going to tell you that they are continuous vectors. That means they are continuously labeled. That was the feature we also introduced about the coherent states at the beginning. So what that means is that there is some meaning of L going to L prime in the underlying label space. Think of it just like Rn, if you will. And the vectors then strongly go to the vector themselves. And I'm going to say that they span the Hilbert space. Now, we know of certain sets of vectors which we often use. For example, let's place this by ket n, just n, where n equals 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. These would be the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. Those vectors are mutually orthogonal. They're all unit vectors, ideally. They can be mutually orthogonal, but they're not continuously labeled by their parameters. Another set we like to think about often is the eigenvectors of the position operator, often called ket x in there. They are not normalizable. They have the delta function normalization. And while they span the space, they are not, strictly speaking, continuously labeled by the parameter. Yes, the parameter x comes from a space with a continuous labeling, but we have chosen to label the parameterize the vectors in such a way that it is not continuous themselves. Okay, so that's not the kind we want. It's much more like the coherent state kind we're talking about. In any case, that's our goal. So the fact that they span the Hilbert space means that I can take linear sums here, say 1 to capital J with suitable coefficients, and get a vector psi, or 1 to capital K with suitable coefficients, get another vector phi. J can be finite, K can be finite, and they can be members of a dense set of vectors. Dense set means just like the rationals in the reals. They are everywhere you want to be, and as close to the to a real as you want it to make. So I can make this vector as close to any vector in the Hilbert space by taking capital J, large enough and still finite. Okay. That's our abstract vector characterization. But I now want to give it a functional realization, a functional representation. You know, abstract is nice to work with, but I want the tangibility of a function. So all I do is I say I'm going to take the overlap of those vectors with the vectors I know that span the space, namely this elements of the set originally started with here. So psi inner product with L, I'm going to call that function psi of L. It's the representative of the abstract vector psi in L. Okay, L is not an orthonormal basis. Get over it. You'll live. It's okay. How is it defined? It's defined as the inner product of L with this vector here. So it's a linear combination of this overlap matrix quantity. Same thing for phi, the functional representative for phi of L, given this way, again, a representative, a linear combination of this overlap matrix. So I now have functional representatives of my abstract vectors. What am I going to choose for the inner product? In order to make a Hilbert space, I have to have an inner product between two elements. So I take the inner product definition that between psi and phi. I use the physicist's criterion that is linear on the right, anti-linear on the left. Psi and phi, well, since these are representative of these vectors, it ought to be equal to the original definition, inner product of the original definition of those two vectors, and that can almost come straight away from here. Just take I can never remember bra and ket. So take that ket and move it into a bra and bring it over here so that this is the formula for the inner product. So I've now found the inner product between a dense set of functional representatives, and to complete it, to make a true Hilbert space out of it, I make the norm on this, which is then the inner product square root of the vector with itself, and then take Cauchy sequences to complete it. That gives me the full Hilbert space. That's a functional representation of a Hilbert space, and it's composed of continuous functions. Every functional representative is a continuous function because L is continuously parameterized on the left-hand side. Everything in this Hilbert space representation comes from the overlap matrix element of these two sets of vectors. Here it is in the functional representation. Here it is in the inner product. Everything is part of that. This is called a reproducing kernel. And if there's a question at the end today of why it has that particular name, reproducing kernel, I'll be happy to tell you. But point of fact is everything comes from this function. I've underlined the initial letter R, the initial letter K, because I will refer to this as RK later on, and you will jump in your mind to reproducing kernel when I say that. Indeed, what is the criterion if I take an abstract kernel? Abstract kernel of two variables, what is the condition for it to make its own reproducing kernel Hilbert space? Well, I need continuity in the variables, L prime and L. And secondly, I need for every sequence of points Lj and every set of coefficients alpha j, here I have alpha j star alpha k, jk1 up to jj, I'm taking this quantity right here and I'm putting psi and psi to be the same, putting the same vector here. So I have the betas become the alphas, the k becomes the j, etc. I need that to be non-negative. That's what you want with a positive definite inner product. So if the function is continuous and satisfies that, it can be a reproducing kernel for a Hilbert space. And I like to think, and I want you to learn to think, that handing you the kernel is, in effect, handing you the Hilbert space as well that it generates. And we'll talk about that in language later. Here's an extra point. Suppose I have two kernels, and they only differ from one another by a multiplier. So here's my original kernel, and I bring up a number C, like 17, multiply it, and call that my new kernel. What do I get out of that? Well, the representative of a function in the C space uses the kernel K sub C, which is C times the original kernel, so that each representative here is C times the previous representative. Phi sub C then is C times that representative. And the inner product in the C space is using the KC kernel, which is C times the other, so that's C times the original product. Point of fact, if I have two kernels that differ merely by a multiplier, the space of functions they deal with is identical. Identical. Because if this quantity is finite, or I think it satisfies this condition, then multiplying by C in front with a positive number still makes it true. Anyway, the space of functions are the same. What is different is the rule for the inner product. We will occasionally take reproducing kernels and effectively multiply them by constants and talk about new reproducing kernels and thereby the Hilbert space that they live with.
Are you allowed to take a few minutes?
Never. No, because that would violate this criteria. Thank you for that question. Okay. I want to introduce to you today something relatively new. Broke onto the scene about 10 years ago. Projection operator method way of dealing with quantum constraints. Takes the best of the Dirac prescription, in my opinion, and improves on it. Here's the idea. Let's quantize first like Dirac did. So this is a quantization before reduction story. We take our classical constraints, promote the P's and Q's to operators, and take suitable functions of those as our quantum operators. Let's assume again that these are real and these become self-adjoint operators, and let's talk about the sum of the square of these operators. So I'm going to take this A family of distinct quantities and make it into a single one, which is the sum of the squares. And observe the following fact. Here is Dirac's hypothesis. Take the A equations, which are phi A psi physical equals to zero. I say they are equivalent to the single equation, but the sum of the alpha phi alpha squares, that the sum of the squares acting on that same physical vector is also zero. Clearly, if each individual one is zero, I can multiply it by a square, and sum of them, I will have this. But since this is positive here, take the matrix element with psi phys, and you can see that that's a sum of positive terms, each of which then has to be zero, which then implies this term. Okay, so that's no big change. But the change comes when we're going to relax this prescription. We're going to insist that the spectrum not be identically zero, that's of interest to it, but lies in a region near zero. And I'll make that precise as we go right along right now. Let's introduce a projection operator, hence the name. And I remind you their properties. E is our projection operator. It's equal to the square and equal to its adjoint, as eigenvalues 1 and 0. And our projection operator of interest will be a projection of this operator, which is the sum of the squares, onto a spectral interval between 0 and delta squared of h bar. Now, delta here is not a direct delta. It's just the idea that this is supposed to represent a small number, and sometimes it will depend on h bar. If you're mathematically minded, then there is a spectral family of projection operators associated with the self-adjoint operators. This is merely the integral of the spectral family from 0 up to delta squared. And take this projection operator, let it act on the original Hilbert space. That will give you a physical Hilbert space, at first regularized by the parameter delta squared. And then the final step, as we'll see in applications here, is going to reduce this delta appropriately. Sometimes it will go to zero, sometimes it does not go to zero. Okay. So let's give three basic examples. Let's take the rotation operators, J1, J2, J3. The sum of the squares you know as the Casimir associated with the rotation group. You even know what its eigenvalues are. J times little j. Little j times j plus 1 are its eigenvalues. And those j's can be 0, a half, 3 halves, etc. So 0 is a possibility for the sum of these squares. That's the one I'm interested in, to make all the jk 0. The next excited state would be when I had a spin one half. That would be one half times three halves. That's three quarters h bar squared. But I've deliberately chosen my h bar squared over two to be less than three quarters. So this excludes spin one half. It excludes spin one. It excludes all the higher spins. Includes only spin zero. So this is a projection operator equivalent to enforcing all jk is equal to zero. Secondly, suppose we had two constraints in our second example, P and Q. P and Q. What is the commutator between Q and P? It's proportional to the identity. That's what Heisenberg teaches us. So if I say my physical vectors should satisfy Q on them equals zero, P on them equals zero, then it satisfies the commutator on that equals zero, but the commutator is the identity effectively. So that says the vector, there is no vector satisfying that criterion. And in fact, that's absolutely true. When we take the sum of the squares, which is our prescription here, and set it to be less than a certain parameter here, little less than or equal to h bar, I claim there are solutions to this equation. Think of this as a Hamiltonian, the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian. And this is the ground state energy. There should be a 2 here and a 2 here to give you the traditional behavior. But this projects onto those states for which Q plus IP acting on that physical state is zero. If Q and P are reducible operators because there are more variables in the problem, then you look for the manifold of solutions to this. On the other hand, if Q and P are irreducible, as for a closed system by itself, then this simply projects onto the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, which is appropriate here. You don't reduce the H bar any lower. You don't reduce it any lower. Of course, you can make it a little bit bigger. You don't want to go up to 3 H bar, which then includes the first excited state as well. There's a little interval in here which gives you the right thing.
How do you know?
Well, you test it. Let's look at these two examples right now. Example 1 and 2. They have operators in the projection operator here, this operator and this operator, which have discrete spectrum. We know that this has a discrete spectrum. We know that this has a discrete spectrum. But they differ in an important way. The spectrum of number 1, J, includes 0. That includes, that's the zero spin situation. Zero angular momentum. The spectrum of number 2 does not include 0. If the spectrum includes 0, that corresponds to a first class constraint. If the spectrum excludes 0, that's characteristic of a second class constraint. And yet the projection operator method is not restricted only to first class constraints. It deals with both of them, provided you don't reduce this delta beyond the suitable limit. Well, let's finish this sheet for today. Number 3. We have a single constraint, Q. Q squared less than or equal to delta squared. Q goes to 0, but it lies in the continuous spectrum. And we'll tell you what the difficulty with this system is. We'll sketch the ideas, and on the next transparency, waiting for you with the next lecture to come in this coming Thursday in the same room after we've had our cookies and things this afternoon. Yes. Here is the sketch of the problems associated with this zero in the continuous spectrum. Suppose I take the expectation value in a certain vector of this projection operator. Well, what does it mean? I put in the x representation here that diagonalizes everything around, and it says that Q must live between minus delta and plus delta in the integration. So this is a strict evaluation of the left-hand side over here. And as delta goes to 0, this thing vanishes because these are all square integrable functions. So this is finite and getting smaller and going to 0. So I want it to go to 0. I want delta to go to 0 because that is the limit that I can make in this case. Well, but I observe that if I divided by 2 delta here, the width of this little interval, it would be now integral from minus delta to plus delta divided by 1 over 2 delta. And provided the function inside was continuous, that would go to this answer over here. This would act like a delta function in x, picking out the value of the function phi at the origin. Again, as I say, provided phi of x is continuous at zero. Of course, this is Hilbert space, and there's no reason for the phis to all be continuous. Plenty of them are not continuous. Plenty of answers would have no limiting behavior. Plenty of answers would have diverging behavior. When we get together on our next occasion, ladies and gentlemen, we'll see how we can resolve those kind of problems. Thank you.